This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 7th of July 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme...
We have made it very clear that successful economic relationships are very tightly linked to human rights and civil society developments.
As Angela Merkel tours China, we'll be joined by former British diplomat Jim Hoare and George Brock, head of journalism at City University, to discuss that and the day's other big stories in Asia and Europe. Then, as the Tour de France winds its way through the streets of London, we speak to cycling journalist Ellis Bacon about what makes two wheels so good. All that, plus a review of the best art exhibitions lighting up Italy, a check-in with our correspondent in Budapest, and we'll even play you a song, I promise. That's Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So, as ever, rather a lot to pack into the next 60 minutes. And first of all, here's Suzanne Chislett with the latest news from around the world.
Hamas says six people were killed after Israeli airstrikes in the Gaza Strip today. Israel says it targeted militant bases in retaliation for an increasing number of rocket attacks across its border, but insists the militants died when one of their bombs blew up and not because of the strikes. The latest action follows the kidnapping and killing of three Israeli youths and the death of a Palestinian teenager, which have raised tensions. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has spoken to the family of the Palestinian. The government spokesman is Mark Regev.
He wanted to speak to them, first of all, to offer condolences, and secondly, to express his outrage at this heinous crime. He ordered the police to aggressively investigate and find the perpetrators, and we were pleased to be able to tell the family that those individuals are now in custody. He also wanted to tell the family that Israel is united in its condemnation of this sort of vigilante violence. There's simply no room in Israel for this sort of behaviour.
Election officials in Afghanistan have declared that former World Bank economist Ashraf Ghani won last month's second round of a presidential election. Official figures from the preliminary results show he won 56.44% of the vote. Talks have been taking place between Mr. Ghani's representatives and those of his rival Abdullah Abdullah after he made accusations of ballot rigging. A senior Ukrainian official has revealed plans to blockade two major cities which remain in rebel hands after government forces retook two more towns in the east of the country. Pro-Russian separatists still hold Luhansk and Donetsk, but have reportedly lost control of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk. Ukraine has again accused Russia of massing tanks and armoured personnel carriers near the shared border. Australia's High Court has issued a temporary injunction preventing the return of a second boat of more than 150 asylum seekers from Sri Lanka. The move follows confirmation from the Immigration Minister, Scott Morrison, that 41 others have been handed over to the Sri Lankan military after being processed at sea. Police in Sri Lanka have said they'll be charged with leaving the country illegally and, if found guilty, will face rigorous imprisonment. Mr. Morrison defended the decision to return the asylum seekers on Australia's Nine Network.
This is how you stop the boats. This is how it has to be done, because this is what works. And that's why we're sticking to it. I mean, I was there in the Parliament when people got up and wept and all of those things. Now, that was the daily reality that I was dealing with when I was a shadow minister, and to be fair to the government and the ministers that they were dealing with. There was no way I was going to allow this continue on our watch, and that's what we've done. And it's a tough job, but it's getting done.
The Pope has told victims of sexual abuse by Roman Catholic clerics that the church should weep and make reparation for crimes which he said had taken on the dimensions of a sacrilegious cult. Pope Francis met six victims of abuse, two each from Ireland, Britain and Germany earlier, and also held a mass for adult victims. The Vatican spokesman is Father Federico Lombardi.
If you see the person that came out of this meeting with the Pope, you understand it was not a public relation event, but is a very profound spiritual encounter and dialogue with a pastor, a father, a person that loves, understands, tries to understand deeply.
Tributes have been paid to the former Georgian president and the last ever Soviet foreign minister, Eduard Shevardnadze, who's died aged 86. He was one of the leading figures to shape Mikhail Gorbachev's policy of perestroika, transforming the Soviet Union, and helped to oversee the withdrawal of Soviet forces from Afghanistan in 1989. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Suzanne Chislett, thank you very much indeed. It's 18.05 here in London, 13.05 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. My guests today are George Brock and Jim Hoare. George Brock is head of journalism at City University, and Jim Hoare is a former British chargé d'affaires, in Pyongyang. He's now at the Centre of Korean Studies at SOAS here in London. Jim and George, welcome both to the programme. We're going to start tonight with Angela Merkel's three-day visit to China amid tours through factories and some tiptoeing around human rights issues. This visit is clearly about trade agreements, of which Merkel has already signed a few today, including a deal on two new Volkswagen factories and the sale of 123 helicopters. Jim Hoare, trade things aside, we'll come on to those. This is a meeting between the world's two great superpowers, isn't it?
Well, there's one we're seeing, actually, if you think about the United States. The German-China relationship is a good, strong one. It's very difficult to say exactly which European country does best in China, but I think Germany has had quite a strong lead, and German cars have been manufactured there for some years. The links, of course, go back well before the Second World War, and the old Kuomintang army was trained by the Germans at one point. It became weaker thereafter, and it isn't till the 1970s that diplomatic relations were established with the People's Republic of China. But normally the Germans are in the lead. Occasionally France takes over or Britain takes over for commercial purposes, but Germany is very strong.
George Brock, the EU's ambassador in Beijing has been finding it rather difficult to get an audience with anyone in Beijing, because Beijing, if it wants to speak to Europe, speaks to Berlin.
And it's not just in China that that's tending to happen. They're just recognising an internal shift, as there always are internal shifts in big groups and collections, because the Chinese know just as well as everybody else that members of groups, diplomatic groups or coalitions or whatever, communities or whatever, aren't all equal. But I think the really interesting compare and contrast is how hard a country like Britain has to work in China compared to Germany. A British Prime Minister quite recently met the Dalai Lama, and so did Mrs. Merkel. But Mrs. Merkel's country, with a bigger economy, makes cars and white goods, which the Chinese really want. And of course, for Germany, China's a very, very important export market. I don't think we're quite on the same level, alas.
That is an issue, isn't it, Jim Hoare, in that Britain struggles to get an audience in China. Is that partly just because Germany's the bigger, stronger economy, or are there other reasons behind that?
I think there are other reasons. Partly it is the economy. I mean, the Germans have a much bigger manufacturing base than we do, and that matters in China. But I think we bring an awful lot of history behind us that our politicians don't always recognise or want to recognise. Most recently, there's been the Hong Kong handover and the consequences of that, and that still lingers on and rumbles on. But Back in the past, of course, we were the imperialists. When the Chinese talked about imperialism, they meant British imperialism. We were the originators of the opium trade. Others took part in it, but nobody quite as enthusiastically as the British.
And it's interesting how long these things go on. I was in Hong Kong last year. I'm an external examiner at the university. And the university was appointing, as it happened at that point, a new head, a vice chancellor, a president. And everybody predicted that they would be appointing a Chinese head of the university who would be sympathetic, let's say, to Beijing. Lo and behold, they appointed a Brit. Can't have improved anyone's temper in Beijing, that I wouldn't have thought.
Maybe not. Jim Hall, when we look at the purpose of this visit this week, how much do you feel it is about trade? And if so, is there space between trade deals for discussions of politics and, let's say, human rights issues?
Well, having organised one Prime Minister's visit to China when Mr Major was Prime Minister, of course there will be other things discussed. And I'm sure they will discuss human rights, and I don't. But it's been clear that they're not going to do that in public, which is probably more effective with the Chinese. There'll probably be also cultural matters discussed, and there'll be the general broad discussion of world politics and the role of the United States. I'm pretty sure that the question of spying on world leaders will come up as well, and the Chinese and the Germans will have a certain common ground there.
We'll come on to spying in a moment, in fact, George, with you. But actually, Jim, if you wouldn't mind reminiscing a moment about when in the early 90s or mid-90s when you organised a trip there for John Major.
1991. I was the head of the political section in the embassy, and so it fell to me to organise Prime Minister's visits. The other thing I looked after was live animals. So, dead animals were commercial, but live animals were political. It's complex, but the Chinese are past masters at protocol and getting things right. They are very experienced. They have lots and lots of visitors, and they try their best to make their visitors at ease. And as I say, some issues will be discussed, but only behind closed doors. Other issues will come out in the open. And I know you want to talk about spying separately, but I think that will be one that might be paraded in the open. But it will be fundamentally, like all major visits, it will be economic things that drive it, and the need to increase trade and to increase Germany's share of the trade.
George, let's touch on that spying issue, which, yes, both Germany and the Chinese will probably have something to say to each other. Germany and the US have the White House has said that they are working with Germany on this issue of who's been spying where and how. How serious do you think that is as an issue? Because it's obviously, we've been talking about it for some time since the first allegations were, well, in fact, not allegations, they were proven, the first evidence came out. How important are these things to relationships?
I think they can matter, but they can also blow over. It's essential to remember the context here, which is that as far as spying goes, we're talking about hypocrisy on an absolutely industrial scale. Everybody is trying it. Some people are succeeding. And very occasionally, one side or other gets something they're doing disclosed. There is a certain amount of embarrassment. It can, if it gets to a certain level, or be chosen as a cause of argument, cause some real rift or shift. But I rather doubt it. And it would be astonishing if the Chinese, who have been spied on by the Americans from every possible direction and vice versa, didn't have a little bit of joking at the press conference about how the Americans are trying to listen to them. And lo and behold, they've been trying to listen to Mrs. Merkel as well.
Jim Hall, as a diplomat, do you just accept that everything you say is probably being listened to by at least one other country?
Well, I've always worked on that basis, whether it was in South Korea or China or indeed in North Korea. You have to assume that with people who are very suspicious of the rest of the world, that they are listening to you and that you should act accordingly. I think the annoyance with the United States expressed by many countries is that it seems to be so widely spread, going for the top leadership, in Germany and in other countries as well. And the Germans, I think, will be particularly cross because they know that, in theory at least, the British, the Australians, the Canadians and the New Zealanders are excluded from this American sweep-up. And that, I think, to go back to a point that George made about the most important country in Europe, if Germany really is that, and that the one that other countries go to hear about European affairs, the fact that their head of state is being bugged by the United States is not actually a very positive thing as far as they're concerned.
They probably feel they should be seen as just as important as New Zealand.
I suspect a little higher up that scale.
Let's move on to another big issue, again with an edge of diplomacy here. Senior North Korean diplomats have agreed to reinvestigate cases of abducted Japanese nationals in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Jim Hoare, if I can begin with you, how much of a breakthrough is this for Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe?
Potentially, it's very important. If he could solve this issue, and I think you have to put solve in inverted commas, but at least get satisfactory answers on the issue, he would gain a lot of domestic credit. He's made a big issue of it over the years. He was associated with Mr. Kozumi's attempts in the beginning of the last decade to try and solve the issue. But Abe has actually gone a bit further than anybody else. He's actually lifted some of the sanctions, Japan's bilateral sanctions on North Korea. And they're quite important ones that he's lifted. And he's allowing money to be transferred without very tight control from the Japanese authorities to North Korea. He's allowing North Korean ships back into Japanese ports. And he's actually put things on the table that the North Koreans want. So that might be a good basis. I think the problem is that for the North Koreans is, in some cases, they may well not know what has happened to these people. I mean, the 1990s saw massive disruption of the country with floods and other natural disasters. And in some cases, they may not want other people to know what happened to those people. So it is the beginning of what I suspect is a difficult process.
And George Brock, in a broader context, the fact that relations between Japan and North Korea, however slowly, appear to be improving, is no bad thing for the wider region.
No, obviously, anybody with an opening into North Korea, since there's not exactly a lot of openings, can help the North Korean regime in general in somehow to relax, then obviously that would be a good thing. But obviously it would only take, I assume, and Jim might disagree, but it would only take another North Korean missile test, for example, probably to reset Japan back to where it was a month ago. And, you know, it's very, very unpredictable country.
Jim Hoare, is this something we just have to accept? It's with North Korea, it's always one step forward, two steps back, or vice versa?
No, I think the dynamics in the relationship with Japan are somewhat different. If you think Japan is in many ways the one country that you would have thought would have stood out strongly on the nuclear issue more than anything else. And yet, when it comes to it, it's the abductee issue that's come right to the fore every time. And despite nuclear tests, despite rockets, one of which flew over Japan, the first one, the Japanese still come back to talk to the North Koreans. And I know for a fact that their discussions are very bloody-minded and they're very tough negotiations and rather unpleasant if you're on the receiving end of the North Koreans being difficult. But the Japanese want this issue resolved, and it carries a huge domestic weight.
We will take a short break. When we're back, we'll be talking about migration, both in Europe and in Australia. Stay tuned.
If you're looking for a present for a loved one, something for the home, or some luggage to take on the road, why not visit one of our shops? Our beautifully appointed shops in London, New York, Toronto, Hong Kong, and Tokyo sell a selection of the fruits of our collaborations with a number of our favourite brands, including Porter, Hackett, Ettinger, Barena, and many others too. Plus, we can also help out filling in any gaps in your collection of back issues. So why not visit any of our shops today? You're guaranteed a very warm welcome.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, my guest today, Jim Hoare, and George Brock. Let's turn now to issues of migration and asylum at the top and bottom of the world. In Europe, tens of thousands of refugees from East and North Africa have already arrived on Italian shores this year, while in Australia, they rarely get that far. Tony Abbott's government intercepted a boat of 44 Sri Lankan refugees and sent them back, despite the fact some were Tamils, while the High Court has prevented a further 153 asylum seekers from Sri Lanka from being handed over to the Sri Lankan Navy. George Brock, this is obviously in Australia a very heated issue, but there are international laws regarding how asylum seekers should be treated, and there are quite serious allegations that the Australian government isn't abiding by them.
Well, it sounds to me like they're going to fight it out in court again. The injunction given stopping the government moving them offshore, so to speak, is very short. It only lasts until tomorrow, Wednesday, I'm sorry. And therefore, they're almost certain to be back in court very soon. There are international laws, but the pivot of the most international law struggles on this is, do people face a fear of persecution or torture? An extremely difficult and elusive thing to define with any certainty. And what I can see the Australian government being, any Australian government being extremely afraid of, since it's a very attractive place for people from all over Asia to go, is that if it looks like it's going to be easier, that you don't have to set, the bar is set lower for claiming that you cannot be sent back to your home country, it is likely that Australia, despite the distance of sea around it, would get a lot of people, because people take the most extraordinary risks in the most unsuitable boats to try and get to places over a very long distance of sea.
Except, Jim Hoare, that hasn't really happened historically with Australia, has it, in the past 20 years? You haven't seen hundreds of thousands of people coming from elsewhere in Asia.
No, and it is actually interesting that they're coming from the Indian subcontinent, and that is a long way away. So to me, it seems that anybody who attempts such a journey must be pretty desperate. And the Australians are paranoid about being flooded by people from outside. They've always been concerned about a massive inflow from New Guinea area.
And so ironic for a country that was basically founded by people on boats.
Yes. Interesting, in slightly to one side of this, that Mr. Abbott yesterday or the day before said that, this was an empty land when we got here, and when Britain got there, and Britain invested in it, which is a very peculiar way of putting it.
Yes.
And has led to a few protests about such an attitude. Australia is a strange mixture in some ways. I mean, it is very open and friendly in one sense, but it's also very tight over who can come and how they can come. And I think this particular issue is not going to go away. I mean, it's despite the efforts of the Australian Navy stopping boats and so on, some people still must think that it's worth trying.
And George Brock, this is also an issue that Europe has to deal with as well, as we see every year around this time of year that the boats keep coming, and some boats don't even arrive. There's been hundreds of deaths already of boats capsizing in the Mediterranean Sea, and so far Europe's response to this is not much more advanced than sticking fingers in their ears and saying, well, this isn't really our problem.
And I have a lot of sympathy with the Italian government. The Italian government has tended to say, but without any practical effect so far, look, Some of these people are coming to Italy because they expect to be able to move throughout the EU. This is therefore a Europe-wide problem, and we would kindly like, please, some Europe-wide
We're
help.
Just the people at the front door. We're Everyone just else the people in the house at, has
we're
to help.
Exactly. We're just the people at the front door. And are they getting much help from anywhere else? I can't really see that they are. And I think they have, you know, I think they have some case. And either people are going to have to help them, or, I mean, a backwards move, I think. You can see political pressures beginning to stop people getting into Italy in, you know, much tougher ways of trying to stop them. Because eventually you will get, you're liable to get, not instantly, but over time, you would get greater political pressures, I think, in Italy just to deal with this. What people, politicians would effectively say, well, if none of our neighbours are going to help us, we've got to stop these people coming.
Jim Hoare, how close are we, do you think, until there is an Australian-style stop the boats campaign where it, essentially the Navy, Europe's navies are used to turn back poor migrants trying to come to Europe?
I'm not sure we're at that stage, although in a sense we already do it with the people who try to come across the channel through the tunnel and on the ferries. But it is very difficult given the colonial past of Italy and Libya and so on, and Britain in various parts of Africa, to say these people have no claim whatsoever. Or you fall back on they're economic migrants, they're not political migrants, and with economic migrants you don't have to accept. When the North Koreans, or when the Chinese use that about North Koreans who get into North Korea, of course it's rejected. So we really do have a whole set of double standards floating around the world.
Just briefly, George Brock, do you think that it is possible for anyone, you know, in Europe to make that argument that will look, you know, given how we have benefited from these countries over centuries and what we have done to them, you know, they deserve to be able to allow, you know, if they want to come here and they can get here, then fair play to them.
Do I foresee politicians in any European country, Western European country, making that argument, Steve? No, I don't.
Okay. Let's turn to another country with democratic issues. Well, this is a good democratic issue. Indonesia this week goes to the polls. It's the world's third largest democracy. 190 people are registered to vote. Jim Hoare, interesting fact that we learnt about Indonesia earlier on today on Monocle 24, that from east to west, it's as long as from London to Tehran. This is a big old country with hundreds of different issues.
It's a huge country, and although the term "it's a democratic country" is being bandied around, it's only been democratic for a very, very short time.
It's so a country which is having elections.
It's a country which is having elections. It may well be on track to become a real working democracy, but I suspect that a lot of old habits and old customs linger on. And that is a complication. It doesn't mean to say that some people aren't trying to conduct elections fairly, but old traditions of how you conduct elections, I suspect, have not gone away entirely in Indonesia.
George Brock, Indonesia is a country that, you know, it's in the G20. It is becoming more of it's certainly a regional power. Do you think it has the possibilities of becoming more than that?
Yes, I mean, it is on track to become, I think, the world's third largest economy at some point in the future, if it continues its track and everybody else stays on trend. It, however, is a country which does not have much culture of using its leverage elsewhere, because its economy is, very, very big in its own right. It has not had to worry too much about its external connections. They have no, you know, they're not part of the diplomatic network or the kind of China, Japan, North Korea, South Korea thing we were discussing a few minutes ago. So I think it would be an extremely slow track. They would do that. However, they are part of a very, very large worldwide Muslim community. They may have 17,000 islands and an awful lot of different ethnic groups, What did the man who is just ahead in the polls do? He went to Mecca to complete his campaign. Pictures of him wandering around that huge black stone.
We will be covering the Indonesian elections in much more detail all this week on Monocle 24, particularly on The Globalist, so do tune in for that. For now, though, George Brock and Jim Hoare, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, eu sou London. This is Monocle 24.
Outlondo, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London,
this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And coming up in the next half hour here on Midori House, we'll talk cycling, art, and some bits and bobs from Budapest. But first, here's Suzanne Chislett with the world news headlines.
Thank you, Steve. Israel has called up reserve troops amid increasing tensions with Palestinians in the Gaza Strip after Hamas said six of its fighters were killed by Israeli airstrikes earlier. Israel denies that. Hamas has vowed revenge for what it said were the deadliest attacks in a surge of violence following the kidnapping and killing of three Israeli youths and a Palestinian teenager. The United States has called for a full and thorough investigation into allegations of irregularity in the Afghan presidential election. The Afghan Electoral Commission says preliminary results show former World Bank economist Ashraf Ghani won last month's runoff. Australia's High Court has issued a temporary injunction preventing the return of a second boat of more than 150 asylum seekers from Sri Lanka. 41 others, who were handed to the Sri Lankan military after being processed at sea, have been told they'll be charged with leaving the country illegally and could face rigorous imprisonment. And the Pope has told victims of sexual abuse by Roman Catholic clerics that the church should weep and make reparation for crimes which he said had taken on the dimensions of a sacrilegious cult. Pope Francis met six victims of abuse earlier and held a mass for adult victims. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. It is 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. We're going to none of those places right now. Instead, we're heading to the heart of Central Europe, to Budapest, where our correspondent there, Adam Labor, is standing by. Adam, welcome to Midori House. We've got some big weighty issues to get through. Let's begin with is it an attack on Bertelsmann? Is Bertelsmann really under attack?
Well, there's a kind of undeclared state of war between Bertelsmann and the Hungarian government now. And the backstory is that the Hungarian government introduced an advertising tax on advertising revenue. And smaller operations aren't really affected that much because it's linked to the amount of money that comes in. But the most you can get taxed is 40% of your advertising revenue. And the consensus is pretty clear that this is aimed at RTL Club, which is a commercial TV station owned by Bertelsmann. And they're saying that it could put them out of business. And how they've responded to it is quite interesting, is that they've suddenly started running a lot of investigative pieces and stories about people close to the Prime Minister, such as the mayor of Felchert, the small village that he came from, and his father, who's a very successful businessman. And all of a sudden, they're all getting probed and investigated and reported on.
Now, would they also claim that they're being targeted because because they're big and they don't necessarily toe the line?
Well, I think before there wasn't. What's interesting about it is that there wasn't much of a line. Any much interest in RTL Club in towing any line or not towing it. I mean, most of what they put out is kind of fairly commercial stuff, daytime soap operas and popular things, but RTL Club was not known for its hard-hitting journalism. But now all of a sudden it's sort of doing very aggressive reporting. And I think that's their response to this new advertising tax. And the thing is, they're part of Bertelsmann, which is a very powerful German media conglomerate, and which almost certainly has the ear of Angela Merkel, who, as we know, is probably the most powerful politician in Europe. And also, the Hungarian economy very much depends on German investment, especially German car companies have a lot of manufacturing plants here. So it's going to be very interesting to watch how this plays out if the government does back down.
Indeed. This isn't the only issue regarding democratic freedoms in Hungary. The Council of Europe, its human rights envoy, has been in Hungary and had some concerns, it's fair to say.
Yes, the Council of Europe's human rights envoy came to Budapest. He met with a lot of people and talked with a lot of people. And he said that, you know, he does have concerns, and there's a specific row going on here at the moment, which is between the government and Norway, because Norway and Iceland and Liechtenstein are part of a grant-giving program, and they support various NGOs and civic organizations. And the government says that these NGOs and civic organizations are too close to opposition political parties, and they've sent in officials of the state, the government control office, slightly 1984-ishly named government control office, to audit them. And have reportedly said, if you don't let us audit you, we'll take away your tax number, which means you can't function. But Norway and these NGOs, which, I mean, it's fair to say they are all sort of on the liberal left end of the spectrum, which is the opposite end of the government of Hungary, they've said, you have no jurisdiction over us because this is not government money. So how can you send in the government control office because it's money from Norway? And Norway's really put its foot down as well and said, you know, you have, Hungarian government has no right to poke about here. The Hungarian government says we have every right to poke about here because you've got a bunch of leftist liberal politicians and their mates giving each other money. So, you know, yet another standoff. It's, you know, it's like the Wild West out here.
Indeed. One bit of bright news is that 10,000 people took part in Pride Parade on Saturday. They had to have a bit of a police escort, though, didn't they?
Yes, they do. I mean, gay pride here has a very difficult past. It's fair to say this is a very conservative society, like many of its neighbours, and there's still a lot of prejudice against gay and lesbian people here. But slowly, especially among the younger generation, it's you know, the tolerance and the kind of acceptance level is rising. And in previous years, the gay pride parade has been physically attacked by right-wing, far-right demonstrators, you know, hurling bricks and bottles and trying to jump over the fences and really attack the parade. But a lot of embassies here every year put out a statement of support, something like 20 embassies, most of the Western European countries and Australia and America and Canada. You know, they put out statements of support. And I think behind the scenes it's been said, you know, you've got to buck up your policing and protect this. And that has indeed happened. And also, you know, every year it's the people who are opposed to it, you know, they're losing the kind of the battle in a way, because it's becoming more and more institutionalized, and many people might not like it, but they're not going to go on a counter demonstration, as has happened in the past.
Excellent. Okay, so some good news in Hungary. Adam Labor in Budapest, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment.
Every other summer, the international architecture community sail into Venice to contemplate the world of architecture. This year's Biennale, curated by Rem Koolhaas, was a fundamental study in modernity and national identity. And Monocle Films reports back.
Although patriotism has long been at the heart of the Biennale, with each of the handsome national pavilions lined up in the Giardini, Koolhaas's theme invites reflection on the notion of national style, instead of posturing, self-promotion or peacocking.
Soft Power Ambassadors at the Venice Architecture Biennale, now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism, at Monocle 24 we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, at 1840 here in London, at 1740 in Reykjavik, and what time? 1340 in New York City. Now, the third stage of the Tour de France has just come to an end, about a mile or two from our studios here in Marylebone. We haven't quite seen the crowds here that made it such an incredible event in Yorkshire over the weekend. Around 2 million people are thought to have lined the streets there. Cycling is undergoing something of a renaissance, and so too, would argue my next guest, is writing about cycling. Ellis Bacon is the co-founder of the Cycling Anthology, and he joins me now. Ellis, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you.
Before we talk about your very handsome tomes here that I'm holding in front of me, all four of them, the Tour de France, or the Tour de France de Yorkshire, as it's been over the past two or three days, it's been remarkable, hasn't it, in the way that it's captured the attention of people that would not normally necessarily be that interested in cycling.
It has. I mean, last time it was here in Britain in 2007 when it started in London, it was quite huge. I think people were surprised. But 7 years on, it's got bigger again, I would say. I mean, no one really knew just how big it was going to be, but I think the tour organisers themselves have been, pleasantly surprised would be an understatement, I think. Just such huge, huge crowds.
There are things that, if you've lived away from a country for a few years, as I did a while ago, that when you come back, you notice that just didn't happen before. And one was, I must say, when I came back to London, was skinny jeans. That wasn't around before. But the other was, that was really huge, was suddenly everyone was cycling, which, you know, at the end of the 90s, early 2000s, that wasn't really happening. And then in the middle of the last decade, suddenly everyone seemed to start cycling.
Yeah, well, I used to live in Copenhagen, which is obviously an extremely big cycling city. So I moved to London in 2003, I think. And yeah, there didn't seem that many people cycling then, but you sort of suddenly did start to notice over the next few years it coming, getting bigger. And I mean, these days in London, it feels as though almost everybody's cycling to work.
And one of the things that is fascinating about cycling, and something that you demonstrate so ably in this, the Cycling Anthology, which volumes 1, 2, 3, and 4 we have right here, is that it also inspires lots of fantastic writing.
It does. And that's not really a new thing. It's strangely, even before cycling did get big, there have been a lot of cycling books out there for the last couple of decades. Obviously, they're more popular than ever. People are buying more of them. But it's the kind of sport that has always lent itself quite well to sports writing, I think. Perhaps comparable with sports like boxing, cricket, sports with a lot of history and a lot of sort of human interest characters that you can really try and delve into and find it more a lot more about.
Is it, I mean, I was going to say, is it sports where it's about the individual? But I mean, there's no similar history of golf writing in that same way.
No.
I mean, there are, people do write about golf, but you know, it would bore anyone to tears. Whereas cycling, you don't have to be a cyclist or even really interested in cycling to get the human emotion of
it. No, I think so. There are so many themes to cycling. I mean, there are autobiographies, of course, but I mean, the history of it, you know, the racing side of it, the sort of more social side of it. There are just so many themes in cycling, both as a sport and as a mode of transport. And I think that's why there are perhaps such a breadth of books out there.
And since we talk about the breadth of books, let's talk about the Cycling Anthology, which you co-edited with Lionel Burney. What encouraged you to begin with this project, and how much of it was original writing? How much was it stuff that you'd seen before? You thought, we need to bring this to a bigger audience.
Yeah, well, both Lionel and I were already cycling journalists and writing about cycling for a living for various magazines and newspapers. And it was actually Lionel who came to me. He, with his he won't mind me saying, quite small publishing company, was already publishing books about Watford. He's a big Watford fan. I should say that the football team, that
right,
is. Not,
yes.
not necessarily the town.
not the town. You know.
Anyway, he came to me with this idea he had and got me on board. He'd heard I was thinking of doing something similar with a website, which is, watch this space. But yeah, it is all original writing. We wanted it to be original stuff. So it was kind of a case of bringing together people we knew between us, journalists, writers, specifically about you know, cycling journalists and writers, and to allow them really a place where they could write about things that they weren't necessarily being commissioned to write at their magazines or their newspaper. So it might be sort of a more of a fun idea they'd had, or an interview they'd had with someone that they necessarily didn't feel they could use somewhere else. So as I say, yeah, it's all original writing. And we've been kind of, I don't know if lucky is the right word, but people have come to us with very, very different ideas. It really is an eclectic mix in every book. So as I say, so far we've been lucky that all the ideas we've had from people who've come to us, we haven't had to say, oh, no, sorry, you can't do that. That, you know, it's not right for us, or somebody's already doing something like that. So it's been great so far.
And what are the particular highlights from, and I'll allow you to choose from any of the four volumes, and obviously nothing you've written yourself, but any particular highlights of examples of great writing which you think will really stand the test of time?
Yeah, there's loads of great stuff in there. I mean, in the latest volume four, we've got Keith Bingham, who is a long-time writer, now retired, long time at Cycling Weekly, and he's written an essay. They're all essays, really, I'd say, but a great piece on when the tour first visited Britain, which was back in 1974, 40 years ago now, actually, when it went to Plymouth and actually went up and down the newly opened Plimpton Bypass with crowds nowhere near as large as, not even close, as large as we've seen in the last few days. And Daniel Freeve did a great piece on cyclonomics, I think it's called. It's a bit like the Billy Bean. Yes,
or,
exactly.
Yeah,
or the Billy Bean baseball fan, Moneyball, exactly. That film with that Brad Pitt's in. So it's about how managers these days are sort of have brought cycling into the 21st century in a sort of looking much more at stats and value for money. Those are two highlights, I'd say.
Wonderful. Ellis Bacon, thank you very much for coming in. The books are the Cycling Anthology, volumes 1, 2, 3, and 4. And just before you go, who did the design? Because it's wonderful, striking design.
Yes, that's a man called Simon Scarsbrook, who also works on magazines like Cycle Sport and Cycling Weekly. So, we're thrilled with the designs he's done for us.
They're brilliant. And they're out on Yellow Jersey Press right now. Ellis, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. We're going to be in Italy very, very soon. To take you there, here's the Beach Boys.
Hold you tight, hold you tight. station. The streets there a beautiful sight. In good time sunshine you'll feel alright. We'll maybe even do an afternoony light. You're sure to get as high as the clouds above. Participating in this little dance of love.
There we are. Beach Boys there. Beautiful day. Now, to end our show, it's time for a bit of a review. And today we're heading to Rome to talk to Luca Mastrantonio, culture editor of Corriere della Sera, about the exhibitions that he's been most inspired by this week. Luca, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Steve. Hi, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. We're going to look at two exhibitions, one in Milan, one in Rome. Let's start in Milan and an exhibition by the wonderful Brazilian photographer Sebastião Salgado. Tell us about this work.
Yeah, it's a great photographer. We don't have to explain his work, but the Genesis, the last work of Salgado, has a particularly maybe dramatic warm, because Genesis is just like a way or show what remains of the earth, just like God, or something like God, gave to us in the past. Because as Salgado wrote in the book of the exhibition, there's he said 55% of the world that is still the same from the Genesis, but we are losing this part of the earth. And so we have 200 photographs in black and white, of course, is the mark of Salgado, that show the beauty, the dramatic beauty of the planet, man, animals, wild nature, coal mines, is not, of course, wild nature, the coal mines. And the mission of Salgado is really clear, is to presentation, the warm, the danger of losing what remains wild. And the work that took the last 10 years, and so it's a big work, after Rome and Venice, now in Milan, in Palazzo della Ragione, and I suggest absolutely, because it shows the relation we don't have to lose with nature, with wild nature, and with our vices, with the earth.
So now, Luca, a lot of people will be familiar with Salgado's work. Was there anything in this exhibition that really surprised you or made you look at his work in a new way?
Yeah, maybe there's something, I don't know if it's about the age, because he's about 70, I think. Yeah, there's something a little more apocalyptic. Sometimes the problem with, my personal problem sometimes with Salgado is, it seems too much cool because of the black and white, because the contrast between the black and white and all the degrees, and sometimes it's too pretty. Now there's of course a message. It's a stronger message. We have a place, the earth, that is we are losing. This place. That is the message of this work, and I think there's something more similar to a prophet. It's not only a report work. There's something different in the maybe it's connected to the age. of the photographer, and maybe the age of the Earth that is going a little older.
And Luca, let's move on just to the other artist that you've been that you were recommending for us. Again, it's a Latin American artist on display, this time in Rome at the Scuderia del Quirinale, and that's Frida Kahlo. Now, obviously, again, we all know Frida Kahlo. What is it about this exhibition that that really makes it stand out for you?
Yeah, for Italy, is because we have a lot of masterpieces that we never see in Italy. And the exhibition covered all the career of Frida Kahlo from the very beginning, with some great self-portraits, wearing a velvet dress. It was done in the 1956. She was 19 and was to the beloved Gomez Arias, and to the very end of her career. So it's a panoramic self-portrait of Frida Kahlo. And one of the masterpieces, famous, you can see in this exhibition, is the sketch for the Henry Ford Hospital. That is, of course, a main part of his biography also, not only of the work. So, I mean, this is a classic. It's the particularity is to see all these masterpieces came from especially private collection. That is a problem when you have a big name like Frida Kahlo.
Well, indeed.
You can't collect. Yeah, it's a good way. It's until the end of the summer, and so I think it's a great match.
And is it making people in Italy, art critics, sort of reappraise what they thought of Frida Kahlo?
Yeah, I mean, in Italy, it's not so well known as maybe in the rest of the world, because Italy doesn't used to look to the center and the south, to the center and the south of America. In the last years, we look to the North American and to the England, of course, with the new classic. And so also with the modern art, we have a lot of great painters. And so in Italy, there's it's well known, but it's not so really known, Frida Kahlo. We don't know a part of the masterpiece we see in the book. So it's something.
Well, this is an opportunity for Romans, in fact, all Italians, to acquaint themselves with Frida Kahlo. She's on in Rome. Sebastiao Salgado's show Genesis is in Milan. Luca Mastrantonio, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. Always a pleasure to have you on. That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, George Brock and Jim Hoare. Midori House was produced by Isabel Kayser. It was researched by Gaia Lutz and Johan Lauchs. And our studio manager was Bill Luty. Next up, after the headlines, in fact, after the full news bulletin with Suzanne Chislett, it's Culture with Robert Bound. So do stay tuned for that. He has a wonderful show, as ever, lined up for you. The Monocle Daily is, of course, with you as well at 2200 hours. Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours here in London, 1300 hours in New York City. My name is Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.